Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is a special presentation. This week, we are doing an in-depth original discussion and investigation into the coronavirus. What is accurate? What is inaccurate? The biases in the media, the prejudices towards a mandatory vaccine that will be, well, it will not be tested properly. Anthony Fauci, yesterday, under oath, always different what someone says under oath versus what they say when they're just doing a commentary or being interviewed on television. He said there is no certainty this will be an effective vaccine. Well, how about there's going to be an absolute certainty there won't be a single healthy ingredient in any vaccine because there's never been a vaccine that's had healthy ingredients. It doesn't work that way. We have done an article. In fact, right now, today, I'm writing a new article challenging the New York Times, challenging the Washington Post, challenging Anthony Fauci, and certainly challenging Bill Gates about their history of safe and effective vaccines. In effect, this is the greatest fraud ever perpetrated upon the world community, that vaccines are the ticket to protecting you from different maladies and diseases. If they have the science that shows a vaccine is safe and effective for any given person, I would absolutely support it. But our research of thousands and thousands of hours have shown just the opposite. Yet they had the power to control the dialogue, and that's where we're going with this. Unfortunately, most people will welcome a coronavirus vaccine. What will happen is this. A, it will not be tested in humans in any classical gold standard study, a placebo-controlled study where the placebo is a saline solution, a salt solution. They've never done that. B, they will fast-track it, just like they did with AZT, and look at the deadly consequences of how many people died by the hundreds of thousands because they believed what the activists were telling them. Put time on your side. Take AZT. It did just the opposite. In fact, any doctor today using AZT in the same amount, 15 to 1600 milligrams, that they did back after it was developed, would lose their license for practicing bad medicine. That would be malpractice. But no one ever criticized the activists who were aligned with Burroughs Wellcome, the makers of AZT, nor will anyone criticize Anthony Fauci or Bill Gates or the World Health Organization for the mistakes that they're about to make, nor hold them accountable for previous mistakes. All I can do is present good, qualified, scholarly material, fully referenced, and you can choose to read it, review it, or not. But that's where we're going. Today, an original, in-depth investigative report on Bill Gates. Richard Gale and I have spent months collecting data on Gates. In the last 2 days, you've seen a video, an outstanding documentary by James Corbett of the Corbett Report, information you did not know, showing you the tentacles of this person's empire. He is quite simply the most powerful person in the world, yet holds no office, yet controls those who are presidents of countries. We're going to show you a different side of Bill Gates. Then today, something different. I'm going to show you film clips that I found by accident recently that prove beyond a shadow of a doubt, absolute, irrefutable, prima facie, and exculpatory evidence that there were a large group of doctors and scientists who believed the best way to approach AIDS was not with antiretrovirals, though they may have been needed at different times, but rather through natural, non-toxic approaches. The title of the documents were Natural Approaches to Immune Enhancement. I thought that was a part of my documentary on supercharging your immune system. It was not. When I put it in and started to watch it, my first guest was Dr. Joan Priestley. I filmed her on the campus of UCLA in their molecular biology department, along with Dr. Strom, the head of the department, all the other, Dr. Bailey, the other professors, and asked them their opinions. Now, three things become apparent. One, there was no denial of HIV. Two, there was certainly the look at AIDS as being a devastating disease for those individuals who were suffering from it. And three, that there were people recovering and gaining health using natural non-toxic therapies. There are five such interviews in just this one presentation. We're going to do one presentation per day. This is a challenge to Wikipedia, and we have been meeting with lawyers both in the United States and outside the United States because our suits are about to commence, and they will commence worldwide. And we're talking about massive amounts. And I'll get into that the day we launch our suits. We'll do a press conference on the air. But it is approaching, and those who thought they could get away with maligning and destroying reputations and lying, your day has come. Now you will be the person that will be challenged in a court of law. And we have tons of research. This that I'm showing you today, and you can watch this. You can watch the interview by going to prn.fm, and you can watch it. Others can listen to it. But you'll also hear from Dr. Hodes, who came to me in 1987 and asked me, would I help him create a protocol for whom? And he said, for the prison system in New Jersey. I created the protocols. It took nearly a year. They were approved, and we were allowed to go into the prison system in New Jersey. There was one ward that had only HIV and AIDS advanced. I'm talking about not HIV positive, but otherwise healthy. I'm talking about HIV positive, but ARC, end-stage diseases. They would have all died. We worked in that prison system for more than 2 years. The people that we were working with survived, became healthy. In fact, one, as you will hear, Dr. Hodes says, he met on the street in Newark. And the man says, Dr. Hodes, you saved my life. Mind you, I forgot that I even did this, save prisoners' lives. That was the first protocol that I'm aware of in American prison systems that showed that you could stop people from dying of AIDS. So we're about to launch a major effort beginning next week to set the record straight. We've been working quietly on it for a long time. That's our program today. Let us begin. This is entitled Bill Gates, America's Self-Appointed Vaccine Czar. It's currently posted on PRN.fm. Please read it and share it. A puzzle that may baffle the inquiring mind is how a college dropout, a computer nerd without any notable biological or medical background, and at one time the wealthiest person in the world before being unseated by the self-centered playboy, Jeff Bezos, could rise to become one of humanity's leading spokespersons about vaccination. After transitioning away from Microsoft to work full-time for his Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in 2006, funding vaccine development and agricultural genetic engineering seems to have turned into one of Bill Gates' deeper passions. In the past, he has been a public protector of Monsanto's chemical-dependent GMOs and continues to promote the agrochemical paradigm throughout the developing world. Although there is nothing wrong with philanthropic enterprises for causes we believe in, what is disturbing is that a non-medical expert has assumed the role of being a national thought leader on vaccination safety and policy. What people do is less important than their motivations and intentions. Personality-wise, it is no secret that Gates was a difficult boss to work with. He was known to be extremely critical, belligerent, sarcastic, and his anger would often degrade employees. He was a fierce taskmaster, as the Washington Post reported, and Fortune magazine listed him as, quote, an egotistical jerk, end quote, along with other billionaires such as Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos. Now with COVID-19 upon us, some, such as NPR, would call Gates prophetic for warning about viral pandemics 5 years ago. However, there is nothing extraordinarily novel and definitely not Delphian in this pronouncement. Gates is certainly no oracle. As personal experience confirms, such conversations among scientists have gone on in the corridors and cafeterias of biotech firms for over 30 years. More likely is Gates simply fear-mongering to turn his enormous investments into vaccine research and development for a coronavirus vaccine, with the outcome being greater profits, huge profits, massive profits. Never before in humankind heard of profits. We're not talking about millions or billions. We're talking about even trillions of dollars are potential. Because after all, why make a vaccine when you have contacts with the world's leaders in all fields and you can convince them that this should be mandatory? Hence, you're now going from hundreds of billions to trillions of dollars in profit. Hence, I predict that Bill Gates will be the first trillionaire. To call Gates a vaccine and genetic engineering fanatic is an understatement. While lecturing at the elitist TED 2010 conference in Long Beach, California, he slipped a statement while speaking about the dangers of climate change and overpopulation. Quote, "Vaccines, I love them," end quote. His admission was made in the context of his philanthropic strategy, and vaccines play a role that is crucial in his firm conviction that population reduction is an urgent priority for the survival of humanity. Of course, the question that arises is, who should be eliminated from the population? And who is elected from the public to make such decisions? The short answer is, no one. Nevertheless, this agenda is covertly proceeding through foundations, international agencies, nonprofits, NGOs, and of course, private industry, especially Silicon Valley and the pundits in Washington. In 2000, the Gates Foundation founded the International Finance Facility for Immunization, or GAVI. And that organization's Global Fund for Children's Vaccines, both are the leaders in the field. GAVI is a global collaboration that includes governments, health ministries, the Rockefeller Foundation, the World Bank, the World Health Organization, the International Federation of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers, UNICEF, corporate vaccine makers, and other influential entities. All of these are zealot vaccination promoters. One of the organization's goals is to vaccinate every child in Africa. Not, I might mention, to feed locally grown organic produce, not to create hydroponics that could feed people 12 months a year with fresh produce and berries, such as raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, avocados, oranges, lemons, and limes, all of which can be grown in that sustainable environment, inexpensively so. Not to promote putting deep wells in every village with proper sanitation, to build a clinic, a health clinic, that would be able to help people with all the urgent needs they have, from malnutrition to malaria, from tuberculosis to schistosomiasis. No. To collect original seeds, known as heirloom seeds, and to harvest products and then take the seeds and so that they have an abundance of food for the future. No. No, none of that is being considered. Instead, vaccinate them. GAVI has reached out over 960 million campaign immunizations in developing countries. In his deconstruction of Bill Gates' charitable agenda, F. William Endall writes, quote, "Vaccinating a child who then goes to drink feces-polluted river water is hardly healthy in any respect. But of course, cleaning up the water and sewage systems of Africa would revolutionize the health conditions of the continent," end quote. Far more effective would be the foundation donating its billions to improve sanitation and hygiene and provide nutrition to the 2.6 billion people who have little to none for increasing clean water sources, so 900 million global residents can have access to drinkable water, now one in three Africans. Instead, the foundation could be funding thousands of health clinics focusing on chronic illnesses these populations suffer from most. This is simply common sense. Bad water, says Stockholm International Water Institute's director, Anders Bentel, quote, kills more people than HIV, malaria, and war together, end quote. And globally, contaminated water, which kills approximately 9 million people annually, is far more serious as a crisis than the evidence now indicates for coronavirus. Over the past several years, the prestigious British medical journal The Lancet has printed a series of in-depth analysis of the Gates Foundation with disturbing revelations. In a September 2008 article entitled "Misfinancing Global Health, a Case for Transparency in Disbursements and Decision-Making," end quote, the author's investigation came to the conclusion that aside from excessive funding of high-profile Western institutions and organizations, there was, quote, a heavy bias in funding towards malaria, HIV, AIDS, with relatively little investment in tuberculosis, maternal and child health, and nutrition, with chronic diseases being entirely absent from its spending portfolio, end quote. So what does the treatment for the diseases they're funding have in common? Drugs or vaccines? And a later study by Dr. David McCoy from the Center for International Health found that, quote, the grants made by the foundation do not reflect the burden of disease endured by these in the deepest poverty, end quote. None of these findings have been covered to any extent by the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, or any of the other pundits, or anyone in any government body. Seemingly, Bill Gates is riding on the coattails of the COVID-19 panic that has infected much of the global community, when in fact, some analysis, such as one recently out of Stanford University, indicates that the danger is likely way over exaggerated. We have discussed that on previous programs, and I stand by, as a scientist and as an award-winning investigative journalist for 50 years, publishing hundreds and hundreds of original articles, that the entire media today has chosen not to do its homework. It has chosen not to look at the actual death certificates and then see where this was, this person dying from COVID-19, or did that person have COVID-19, completely different. And did they die of other comorbidities? Were they dying in nursing homes where people go to die? Right now, 30 to 50% of all the deaths from COVID in the United States are people in institutions like nursing homes, hospice centers, assisted living, etc. They're there to die. They're over-medicated. They're undernourished. They're neglected frequently in most centers. And they are suffering from lifelong diseases that they're at the end stage of. And yet, none of that is reflected in any honest or accurate manner by Fauci, the CDC, the World Health Organization, the president, or any of the media. Therefore, they're engaging in intentional, and when I believe intentional with malice, to control the entire process. Because if they were honest and showed that 70% of people coming down with COVID do so in their homes, then the people who are most responsible are people who are healthy, are asymptomatic, bring a virus back into the home and infect someone who's got a compromised immune system, and that person then suffers or dies. Therefore, the people who should be contained in environments that are equipped to help them, and that does not mean with ventilators, since the death rate now is up to 88% and growing, and that is against all of the protocols that show that there are healthier ways, including hyperbaric oxygen, that could help people. So the story is being extremely biased in its reporting. This month, Bill Gates announced he would be spending billions of dollars to fund 7 separate coronavirus vaccine development initiatives. As a result, his foundation has emerged as perhaps the foremost leader in the vaccine industry's response to the pandemic. Gates has gained free entrance into the offices and boardrooms of virtually any of the leading players, savoring the opportunity to launch a fast-track coronavirus vaccine that may likely be made mandatory for Americans, including National Institutes of Health Allergies and Infectious Disease Director Anthony Fauci, even though under oath yesterday he said there's no guarantee this vaccine will work. The CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee also, and the World Health Organization, are all influenced by Bill Gates. Thus far, Gates has shown reservation against a hasty launch of a vaccine that will likely not have been reviewed long enough to determine safety and efficacy, and certainly there'll be no proof of long-term immunity. So in effect, in my opinion, Bill Gates, Anthony Fauci, the World Health Organization, and its sycophants and supporters within the media, especially the New York Times, are willing to risk every human being on the planet who gets vaccinated's life in a completely disastrous human experimentation. We've already seen the disasters of the Gates-supported Gardasil vaccines. We've seen the women who died. Did Bill Gates come forward and say, I must take some of the responsibility for that young girl's death, country by country? Did he apologize and take responsibility for the nearly half million people in India who took his polio vaccine who ended up with paralysis? No. So do not expect anyone to apologize now that Gates has advanced the proposition and Congress has supported that everyone involved in the COVID pandemic will be indemnified in the treatments they offer. If you should not have been put on a ventilator and intubated, then you will be, and your patient dies, you cannot be sued. If you give it experimental drugs that are approved by the FDA, even though they're not working, there's been no independent drug studies, long-term with placebo controls, and everyone gets injured or many die, you will not be sued. If everybody on the planet who can be vaccinated is vaccinated with mandatory, you will not be sued, even if every patient died or became sick. I'm merely telling you the tsunami that's about to hit you, but they're telling you just the opposite. This is who they are. This is who Anthony Fauci is. This is how little regard they have for human life. What they care about is power, above and beyond all, or those who want access to power and be able to circle in that repository of absolute extremism. We may recall that Anthony Fauci aggressively pushed for fast-tracking the H1N1 flu vaccine during the swine flu epidemic that never appeared as predicted. He was wrong. People were injured and died. He was called out for his failure by Senator Ted Coburn for advocating a vaccine found to be only 30% effective in its trials conducted in Thailand. Recent studies out of Shanghai already show that 30% of those who contract a wild COVID-19 virus show only minor or no neutralizing antibodies, meaning there is absolutely no proof at this moment, none, zero, not a scintilla of evidence that there is a universally accepted vaccine or drug that could in any way provide protective antibodies against COVID-19. And South Korea is now reporting cases of individuals getting infected with COVID-19 a second time, further compounding and confounding the issue that if it's not protective, then what is the purpose? To this day, there is no HIV virus infection preventative vaccine. They've tried nearly 90 times that I'm aware of, possibly more or less, and every single trial has failed. Other seasonal coronaviruses, which are only mild common colds, return repeatedly and indicate infection triggers only short temporary immune responses, and even then, not in everyone. So someone may be protected for a week or a month or 3 months, and other people not protected at all. Are you willing to play Russian roulette with people's lives? However, not all leading vaccine advocates are on board with rushing a vaccine. During a Philadelphia Inquirer interview with rotavirus vaccine inventor Dr. Paul Offit at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Offit warned against efforts being made to get a vaccine on the market as swiftly as possible. This is a virus, according to Offit, that we still know very little about. He stated, quote, if you're going to be testing this in otherwise healthy people who are very, very unlikely to die from this infection, you better make sure it's safe, end quote. He offers the example of the poorly developed dengue vaccine that was tested in Latin America and the Philippines and found to increase the risk of dengue shock syndrome. The same could be happening with the COVID-19 vaccine. Dr. Peter Hotz dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor University, developed a vaccine against SARS in 2016 before money dried up. Yet in a recent appearance before Congress under oath, he testified a coronavirus vaccine could have, quote, a unique potential safety problem, end quote. We should be warned that questions would remain if and whether Hoetz's team were to get a vaccine into advanced trials. An earlier University of Texas effort to develop a vaccine against the SARS coronavirus was appalling. Despite including neutralizing antibodies, all the mice in the viral exhibited immunopathological events in the lungs. More recently, a global analytical firm, Clarivate, investigated two coronavirus vaccines in the pipeline that have reached later clinical trials. Their report estimates that it will require over 5 years for developing a safe vaccine, and it will likely be only 5% effective. In other words, it will be 95% non-effective, and that's an enormous waste of funding. And also, when it's non-effective, what are the side effects? It is not humanly possible to put any adjuvant into a body, like aluminum, to enhance the infectivity of the pathogen, the virus that's being inoculated into a person's body, without side effects. We have over 3,000 peer-reviewed studies on toxicology of the ingredients used in vaccines. Not one single ingredient can be considered good or healthy for the body. Every single one is toxic and in combination, extremely toxic. Gates, on the other hand, seems to be ignoring these warnings from persons who have devoted their lives to vaccine development. He is stubbornly determined, irrespective of money spent, to get a COVID-19 vaccine onto the market. A question that arises in our minds is how concerned Gates might be of vaccine safety issues. In the past, well, he did something that we should all now stop and question, that no one in the media has questioned. No one at the New York Times, no surprise there, or the Washington Post, has done the background research we have. It appears Bill Gates' focus is to increase vaccine compliance while ignoring the high incidence of serious adverse events and deaths. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. at the Children's Health Defense Organization has listed some of the vaccination debacles that are directly associated with his foundation. In 2002, operatives in the Gates network enforced a meningitis campaign in sub-Sahara Africa that paralyzed over 500 children. No responsibility, no apologies, and no one held him accountable. Is that in any way giving you the idea that we're vaccinating children without the knowledge of what's in the vaccines to their parents in people of minority backgrounds? Why aren't there words of caution or condemnation for this? Now, what would happen, as just an argument, if Bill Gates' foundation decided to go down and get the addresses, home addresses, of everyone who runs a Wall Street bank, a pharmaceutical corporation, a major Fortune 500 corporation, and for argument's sake, let's just say there were 5,000, and then mandate you, not a poor, malnourished, disease-ridden kid in Africa, your children are going to get the vaccines. Do you think that would happen? And why shouldn't it happen? Why should we assume that Bill Gates and the people in power have the right to decide whose life is exposable, disposable, and of no great value? And all else? No. That would never happen. But it did happen to the poor. In 2010, his foundation's support for Glaxo's experimental malaria vaccine trial killed 151 African infants and seriously injured another 1,000, but there was no follow-up to see how many of those thousands who were seriously injured later died. Gates' collaboration with India's National Technological Advisory Group resulted in a catastrophic, unmonitored, overlapping polio immunization program that triggered an epidemic of non-polio acute flaccid paralysis that affected 490,000 children. Gates' vaccine programs were forced to leave India. Cases of vaccine-derived polio now outnumber cases of wild polio. So could we legitimately ask the question, did Bill Gates and his foundations and his cooperative vaccine manufacturers bring polio disguised in a different nomenclature as non-polio acute flaccid paralysis, same identical symptoms and outcome, to almost 500,000 children in India? And again, we're talking about poor children. In 2014, Gates' foundation funds went to experimental HPV vaccine, human papillomavirus vaccine trials in India, in joint collaboration with GlaxoSmithKline, the makers of AZT, and Merck, that violated ethical standards. Over 1,000 girls developed severe autoimmune diseases and infertility disorders. Was there any follow-up to see today what the quality of their life is 6 years later? None. How many of those girls later died? No one cared. No one followed them. Once again, people of color, the poorest on the planet, are fair game to use in experiments by the major vaccine manufacturers, the World Health Organization, Anthony Fauci's support, and of course, at the heart of all that is Bill Gates. So it's easy to overlook the larger significance of the results Gates' vaccination campaigns have had. In short, Bill Gates was responsible for implementing and funding these programs that injured and caused the deaths of innocent children and adults. Not a word from the cowards of the New York Times. How dare you call yourself a journalist and not look into the man who is responsible for so much suffering because he flaunts money, gives money by the truckloads? If you robbed a Brinks bank truck, that would be nothing compared to what Bill Gates puts into people's hands. Put enough money around to universities, to organizations, to governmental agencies, to top people, scientists, and you own them. Due to his stature among governmental and international health agencies, he has not been held accountable at all. People such as Gates are judged by a different standard, similar to Hillary Clinton, meaning they are not judged at all. Equally worrisome, aside from his vaccine frenzy, Gates makes efforts to influence the nation's health policies. In the past, he's been a fanatical advocate for mandatory vaccination. During a recent TED Talk interview, Gates advocated a national campaign to issue certificates for those who have been either infected with COVID-19 or vaccinated against it. Quote, eventually what we'll have to have is certificates of who's a recovered person and who's a vaccinated person, end quote. He stated, quote, because you don't want people moving around the world without their certificates. That should be a big red flag. Gates, however, is a symptom of another side of national crisis. There'd be no need for citizen billionaires to be taking the helm to manipulate national policy responses to health crises such as COVID-19 pandemic if there was in place a functioning healthcare system. Unfortunately, it has been the gross failures of Trump administration, Obama administration, Bush administration, Clinton administration, and Bush senior administrations, Gerald Ford's administration, Richard Nixon's administration. They all failed. Why? Because of ideologies, politics, and money in the lobbyists. All other previous presidential administrations that have opened the doors for others like Gates to step in. For too long, the U.S.'s federal health agencies have been thoroughly compromised and totally corrupted. You will not find a more corrupt organization in America than the Center for Disease Control. Followed quickly behind that is the FDA. Behind that, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. And all corrupted by private pharmaceutical interest. The pandemic is revealing to Americans that we had the most dysfunctional, despicable, completely corrupted, inefficient medical system in the developed world. Unfortunately, the wealthiest elite on the planet are rarely questioned about the correctness of their actions and schemes. As long as the Bill Gates say he is giving huge sums of money to a cause to end disease and suffering, we're not supposed to probe further. Rather, in the case of mainstream media, such people are to be worshipped as saviors. The oligarchical elite are so well interconnected on multiple boards of directors, clubs for the rich and powerful, think tanks, media conglomerates, and among the high ranks of elected legislators and politicians that it is difficult to have an open and honest debate on the merits of their actions and spendings. You will never hear the merits of this discussed at the Council on Foreign Relations, the Business Roundtable, oh, and all the others. So when someone like Ted Turner says we should reduce the world's population by more than half, and Bill Gates suggests a 15% reduction, do we fully understand the potential for eugenic efforts? And this is another issue about Gates that should disturb every person on the planet. As a keynote speaker at the TED conference, Gates laid out his rationale for an international effort towards global depopulation. He said, quote, "If we do a really great job on new vaccines, healthcare, reproduction, health services, we could lower that projected to be 9 billion people by perhaps 10 to 15%, end quote. Again, it is shocking to learn that a tetanus vaccine administered in Kenyan women in childbearing years was purportedly laced with human chorogenic gonadotropin, or HCG, that causes miscarriage and renders a woman sterile. The discovery was made by the Kenyan Doctors Association that noted something was seriously wrong with women following vaccination had the vaccine analyzed, but more appalling was tracing the vaccination campaign to funding by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for distribution by UNICEF. Further evidence is found in a 2005 Foundation press release stating Gates' gift of $26 million to UNICEF for a vaccine to eliminate maternal and neonatal tetanus. Curiously, Brian Silvady at Health Impact News observed, quote, "There was no outbreak of tetanus in Kenya on the perceived threat of tetanus due to local flood conditions," end quote. Therefore, why the campaign to vaccinate young women en masse in a country that did not have a problem? In conclusion, we have the world's second richest billionaire who deeply believes he has a personal authority to be a policy maker for America's public health. Therefore, do we truly realize the dangers of billionaires unelected in any position of authority over the nation and their threats that undermine democracy? I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and go right in to why is this important? Because at the time that I was doing these interviews with these people who were treating successfully with their own protocols, none of this has to do with me except one, the prison one, we were being told the only way that you should treat an AIDS patient is with antiretrovirals, DDC, DDI, and the other protease inhibitors, or AZT, and yet they were dying by the hundreds of thousands. We have the statistics. We have all the documentation. And yet, here are the people who are reversing that. And Anthony Fauci, along with Robert Gallo, were the leading shriekers and getting those activists who would align with them to go after any doctor, no matter what their background or success, in condemning them for using natural therapies. They were not looking at the results. In a moment, you'll hear the first of these individuals.
The virus, to the exclusion of everything else that we could control and look after, is a very limited and fruitless approach. I think that's half the reason why people literally are dropping like flies when they have the AIDS virus. My experience is very different from almost every other physician. I don't have patients dying on me weekly. It's extremely rare that my clients go into the hospital, and it's very, very rare that my clients expire. So I think that we do have the right organism, but I don't think we have the whole picture by any means.
What type of therapy are you using that are keeping your patients alive and well?
Well, I think AIDS is a very complicated, multifactorial situation. I don't think we're ever going to get a handle on this disease by telling people to take some drug five times a day or bend over and take this shot. We have to look at many other aspects and start having people control and change many other facets of their life. I developed a five-point empowerment program because I think there are five avenues that need to be examined consistently, and let's talk about those. The first point of the five-point empowerment program is lifestyle. People have to be willing to make changes in their life to get their stress factor down, stop staying out all night, stop taking recreational drugs, stop drinking alcohol, and stop smoking cigarettes. Easy enough for us to say, but I know that those can be dragons that are very hard to let go of in our society. That's the first factor. The second factor is diet. People really need to clean up their diet. As you well know, we average sugar consumption is in the hundreds of pounds per year, and a high sugar diet is very clearly immunosuppressive. I think that yeast is definitely an unappreciated cofactor. Now, yeasts naturally live in all of us. We just have to achieve a balance of the yeast and us and not let the yeasts get out of control. So part of the diet changes I ask people to do is get the sugar out of their diet, get the alcohol out of their diet, get the white flour and processed foods out of their diet, get the yeasted foods out of their diet as an effort to keep their yeast under control as well. In addition, there's some evidence that the PCP organism, the Pneumocystis carinii organism, is a yeast and not a parasite. So an anti-yeast diet actually is a very self-empowering way of controlling PCP also. So point two is dietary management. Point three is using some forms of drugs when they are appropriate. I think, for instance, taking Bactrim or Dapsone when a person's T cells are under 200 to prevent PCP pneumonia is entirely appropriate. We've learned now, at least the doctors in Los Angeles are making great strides in this direction, people don't die of AIDS. They don't die from the AIDS virus, they die from opportunistic infections that get a hold of people once their immune system has been compromised, whether it's from the AIDS virus or some other unnamed cofactor. So we're keeping people alive a lot longer by giving people means of controlling and preventing the opportunistic infections that tend to come along. I use a drug I think is magical called fluconazole or Diflucan very liberally. I am very in favor of doing whatever works for my clients. When those are drugs, that's wonderful. But I am very much opposed to using ineffective drugs inappropriately, such as AZT. Another area that people need to look at is what I call nutrition of the mind. It's very necessary, I feel, to do a lot of emotional clearing, forgiveness work. I ask my clients who are gay to come out to their family and handle these emotional issues, or those emotional issues will handle them, and develop any sense of spiritual kinship with some kind of benevolent power beyond themselves so that they don't feel like it's just them against the world with this infection. It is my firm professional opinion that AIDS is a chronically manageable infection and will in fact prove to be a curable disease soon, I think. It's just a matter of getting the right combination of therapies and mental and emotional and attitudinal involvement together. I don't think we'll ever get control of this infection with just one drug or one pill. Another thing I have people do, and this is really the fifth point of the five-point empowerment program, is use nutrients as therapy. Now, as you well know, this has been a debate that's raged for years in the medical community of RDA levels, or recommended dietary allowance levels, versus high doses of nutrients being used therapeutically. I use very high doses of certain nutrients which have direct antiviral and immune system boosting or immunomodulatory effects, specifically vitamin C in high doses, a la Linus Pauling, industrial strength doses, I feel is a cornerstone of an AIDS management, AIDS prevention program. I ask all my patients to take vitamin C throughout the day to what is called bowel tolerance doses. Now, the scientific name for that is the diarrhea dose. of vitamin C. They take vitamin C in gradually increasing doses until they get mildly loose stools, and then they back off from their vitamin C levels until their stools are normal again. And this is about 18 to 20 grams per day. Now, we are not talking oranges here. That would be the equivalent of 400 oranges per day. So it's absolutely necessary and crucial to use vitamin C as a concentrated supplement. And I do intravenous nutrients also, where we just stick a needle in someone's vein and pump in a cocktail of nutrients, including high doses of vitamin C primarily. I use intravenous glutathione also, and I have all my clients take on a daily basis N-acetylcysteine, which is called NAC. NAC is an amino acid which becomes glutathione in your body. Glutathione is a remarkable substance. It deserves all the attention that our government and the NIH is giving it right now. Of course, they're trying to find a glutathione derivative, which they can make a patent for and then make a great deal of profit off of. However, glutathione and NAC work extremely well. Glutathione specifically attacks the AIDS virus from about four different steps. So we're looking at an expanded way of containing and controlling the virus with glutathione. Glycyrrhizin, which is a licorice extract, has been proven to do the same thing. It's just that glycyrrhizin needs to be used in very high doses intravenously, and it gets to be rather expensive, especially considering that the insurance companies will basically laugh at this kind of protocol and refuse to fund it. I use garlic, zinc, which is extremely important as an immune system booster, and vitamin A, all in high doses. Actually, the vitamin A is beta-carotene, not vitamin A. Beta-carotene is a safer form, as you know. Another lesser-known fact is that quercetin, which is a bioflavonoid, does have the ability to block reverse transcriptase, which is the way AZT blocks the AIDS virus. So quercetin is a natural person's AZT substitute, and I have all my patients take quercetin on a daily basis. I think that B vitamins are very important in helping the immune system, in avoiding anemia, and especially in avoiding dementia, the mental deterioration that we see with AIDS. I think that people, even early on in the course of their infection, develop problems absorbing many different nutrients, specifically B vitamins. And I've developed a B vitamin complex as an injection, which all my patients take on a weekly basis to get around the absorption problem. In my 5 years of practice with some 600 clients, I have never seen dementia in my practice.
That's very common in most people getting traditional treatments for AIDS.
It is indeed. It is. Dementia is supposed to show up in about 30% of patients in the course of their disease, but I just don't see it at all.
Do you see any reality between all these now risk factors, and as well as the use of recreational drugs, and parasites, and what we're calling the syndrome of AIDS?
Yes, absolutely. I became aware of what we'll call a parasite problem some time ago. The holistic physicians have been much more aware that parasites do constitute yet another epidemic, along with syphilis and gonorrhea and other organisms that have proliferated in our society. I parasite test everyone who comes through the door, whether or not they have any known risk factors, whether or not they have any diarrhea or other gastrointestinal problems, even little old ladies who have no risk factors whatsoever. As you very aptly put it, all we have to do is eat raw foods or drink city water in some cases, and we are at risk for parasites. I use one lab in Arizona, which is called Dowell Laboratories. They ship their parasite test kits around the country. I've seen Dowell Labs ferret out parasites that all other labs have missed. The problem with most parasite testing is that it is notoriously inaccurate. You're literally lucky if other labs pick up parasites. So I always treat for parasites. Yeasts live in us naturally, but parasites, in contrast, have no right to be in our bodies, and they just distract our white cells, and people with the AIDS virus have precious few white cells to work with. So I always treat parasites vigorously to get rid of them, and then retest periodically every 6 months. All my patients take another purge stool test to make sure they haven't picked up new bugs.
And what percentage of your persons with AIDS or regular patient population test positive for parasites?
I'd say about 25%, even with no symptoms.
All right. And, of course, one of the symptoms of parasite is fatigue.
Fatigue, diarrhea, weight loss, anemia, low iron levels. We look at this constellation of symptoms and we think, oh, the disease must be progressing due to the AIDS virus. That's not true. This is another example of cofactors which are overlooked that can be very effectively managed when we think of diagnosing and treating them.
Give us more of your understanding of cofactors.
Well, I think that there's a number of other organisms that need to be managed, primarily yeasts and parasites, as we've discussed, hepatitis, other viruses that are around,
cytomegalovirus,
and syphilis and gonorrhea.
What is your view of the human herpes 6 virus?
It's a relatively new virus. We're just now thinking about testing for it, and we are picking it up in a surprisingly large proportion of the population now that we know to test for it. So herpes 6 is another very active cofactor that can accelerate the basic disease progression.
Some have suggested there is a relationship between human herpes 6 and chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yes.
Chronic fatigue syndrome and AIDS.
Chronic fatigue syndrome has kind of been renamed CFIDS, which is chronic fatigue immune dysfunction syndrome, and has been labeled by some as, quote, AIDS minor. I think that's taking things to a bit of an extreme, but it is very clear that there are new viruses in our population. We don't know how to deal with them. We don't know how to detect them. We don't think about them a lot of the time. Another important cofactor is yet another organism called Mycoplasma. This is another bug that Luc Montagnier feels may be very significant in causing the symptoms which we mistakenly associate with the AIDS virus. I suggest specifically to my patients that they not get a flu vaccine. I think that the contents of the vaccine may be suspect, and it has been definitely shown that with HIV, the vaccine is useless at best and dangerous at worst. I think my AIDS patients are much better off not getting the flu vaccine. Also, for my population, my clients stay so pickled with vitamin C that no self-respecting flu virus is going to get near them. So my clients don't get the flu anyway.
What are your feelings again on syphilis as a cofactor?
I think it needs to be very vigorously tested. Many standard syphilis tests will show up negative in people who have also been exposed to the AIDS virus. When there are 3 syphilis tests that I do on all my patients, and if any one of them is positive, I think about vigorously testing for syphilis. I think this is one more cofactor that we're not adequately testing for and diagnosing in our HIV-positive population.
Dr. Priestley is one of the very few physicians who's willing to speak out against the use of AZT. Just summarize again your feelings and any additional points that you feel we should know about AZT.
Well, AZT is a toxic drug. We do know that. There is a question as to whether it promotes the development of cancer in clients who are taking it long term. This is not being discussed in the research circles or the media. It doesn't do very much. Whatever it does do, it only does it for a short period, and then ultimately the virus becomes more resistant and stronger. I think that there's a possibility that we may see a surge in this epidemic because now we are seeing AZT-resistant virus being passed around. There was a study that the VA did that was finally published. This is known colloquially as the John Hamilton study, which conclusively showed that AZT in the long run did absolutely nothing to prolong life. And indeed, people who took AZT, when they did finally become sick, they became sicker faster, and they died at an equal rate with people who never took AZT. Well, when people first take AZT, they...
Okay, that was Dr. Joan Priestley. I filmed her at UCLA in the molecular biology department, along with the tops of that department. There are 3 things that we learned just now. We learned that in our discussion there was no challenge that HIV or AIDS are real, something that the Wikipedia liars have stated. So we're about to deconstruct that in a major way. In fact, every one of these interviews proved that. This interview was done in 1992. So just imagine that that's over a quarter century ago, and we had it right then. But the people controlling the war on AIDS, the people looking for an AIDS vaccine, including Anthony Fauci, every single one of them failed. The people promoting the most toxic drug ever given outside of thalidomide in American history, causing untold death, is the person running our COVID-19 program today. You really want to take his advice? I think we should stop and think. Tomorrow, we will have the last two programs this week, an all-hour special with Chris Hedges, and then the next day, an all-hour special with Danny Sheehan on the constitutional aspects of this and what it's doing to our rights. And tomorrow, who's behind all this? For those listening over PRN, we will return to our normal programming tomorrow with health and nutrition and other information and the beginning of a new series against Wikipedia. So if you have not got the benefit of downloading our programs, now you will. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.